Pippin against NBC Universal.
May it please the court.
Mr. Gold.
Thank you. May it please the court. The second amended complaint, which is at the your separate appendix, is what this case is all about. District Court ruled that the second amended complaint did not allege sufficient facts to indicate that the defendants in this case were in reckless disregard of the truth. Now, all of the defendants in this case told a lie. They said that Scottie Pippin was bankrupt.
Well, they may have been, they may have erred, but the question is, did the defendants know that he wasn't bankrupt?
Well,
or were they, you know, on notice? They should have realized it. What's your best evidence of that? Best allegation of that, because that's critical. You have to show that.
Well, right, because it demonstrates their reckless disregard. So we asked the question then, what was the basis for them saying he was bankrupt? There was no basis for it.
I'm not asking you that.
Okay, I'm sorry.
What you asked them. What allegation clearly accuses them of reckless disregard or intentional or whatever you want to describe the test as?
All of those allegations in the complaint wherein we allege that they knew at the time they told the world that Scottie Pippin was bankrupt, they cited four or five pieces of litigation in which Scottie Pippin was involved to seek recovery of monies that allegedly were taken from him. One of those specific pieces of litigation even indicated that he received $10 million for one of his claims. Now, those cases and their knowledge that he earned
You can have billions and be bankrupt.
I'm sorry?
You can have billions and be bankrupt. But
there's no question about it.
So why would the fact that he'd gotten a judgment for $10 million show that he wasn't bankrupt? I don't understand that.
Well, those cases raise a red flag. If they know that he earned $120 million, as they knew at the time they declared him to be a bankrupt, and they knew that these cases were to seek recovery of the monies that had been taken from him, and none of those cases that were referred to and known about when they published this falsehood mentioned that he was bankrupt, they had absolutely no evidence that he was a bankrupt. Now,
Judge Posner is asking, what is the reason for the court to conclude that they knew or were reckless with respect to the statement that he was not? What appears to have happened here is a classic rumor chain. Somebody asserts that Pippin filed for bankruptcy in 2003. Other reporters then say the same thing without independently checking. Right? It happens all the time. I dare say it happens even by lawyers. Now, what reason did you provide in the complaint to believe that at the time say NBC repeated what had already been said by others. NBC knew it to be false.
They knew it to be false or had an obvious reason to doubt
right.
that it was true.
Well, we have said it in the amended complaint that they had no, they didn't say in any of these articles, they never said that they heard it from somebody else. Okay? Does that mean that does that excuse them?
You're not answering the question,
okay.
which is what evidence did you point to that when NBC Universal, for example, made this report, it knew it to be false as opposed to not accurately, not adequately checking whether it was true or not properly attributing its sources or, right, there's a long list of things you might say, but we need to know what evidence shows that they knew it to be false.
I think under the law and under the Supreme Court's decision in Hart-Hanks, Your Honor, that all we need show is that they published a lie with knowledge that it was in reckless disregard for the truth.
Well, what evidence do you have that they disregarded the truth?
Okay. We have said, Judge, that they did nothing, unlike in Hart-Hanks.
They didn't check the statement before they published it. That was true, by the way, in New York Times against Sullivan. The Times receives an ad. They did absolutely zero to check whether the statements in the ad were true, and they published it. And the Supreme Court ruled in their favor.
Okay. But in a later decision, the Hart-Hanks decision, at page 688, Your Honor, the Hart-Hanks court, Justice Stevens, went further. A false or defamatory statement with knowledge of a or with knowledge or, you see, I don't believe our burden, Judge,
that's
is that
Sullivan
we have to
case
prove.
Also.
I'm sorry, what?
That's in the Sullivan case also. It's nothing new.
Okay. What I'm getting at is in the Hart-Hanks case, we're not limited to having to allege that they knew at the time they published it.
Judge Posner says that's in Sullivan. But what Sullivan, one of the things you get out of Sullivan, because the Times won New York Times against Sullivan, is that you cannot say they had reckless disregard because they failed to put a fact checker on the job.
That's true. That's true. And that's true. But in Hart-Hanks, our Supreme Court says...
No, you're missing the point totally. Mm-hmm. You have to distinguish between negligence and recklessness, right? So negligence is not actionable when it's a public figure. So you have
right.
to show something beyond
right.
negligence. So what's your best evidence that
okay.
they went beyond?
There is no question that under New York...
I'm asking you a question.
I'm saying that...
No, you are not answering my okay. question. I want you to point to the best evidence that shows that these defendants were reckless and not merely negligent.
Okay. They were reckless because they had nothing to go on to say that he was bankrupt. And in Hart-Hanks, although it's not enough if they don't investigate, the court can take it into consideration if they did anything or if they did poor investigation. The fact is, in Hart-Hanks, there was some investigation. There was a jury trial. And there was a verdict in favor of the plaintiff and against the defendant.
What if they were just repeating something that had been published by some other seemingly reputable source? They just republish it. They don't check it. They figure if, you know, the New York Times said so, probably true, so we'll say so also.
Okay. That's what they're saying. That's what the defendants are saying.
Would that be actionable?
Absolutely, Judge.
No. You've missed the point totally.
Okay.
Because that would be careless. That wouldn't be reckless. Look, most of what we say is repeating what someone else said, right? We don't make up every. We don't create knowledge from scratch.
Okay. I'm not.
So if I just repeat what I've heard, that may be careless. You know, if it's defamatory, you shouldn't do that. That's gossip and rumor and so on. But it's not reckless unless it has to be more for recklessness than carelessness. That's what you don't understand, which is fundamental.
Okay, well, I'll address that. I'm saving 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'm going into rebuttal then. Okay.
Mr. Gold. Mr. Sanders.
May it please the court. As the court's questioning has pointed out, the issue before the court is a very narrow one, and it's whether the well-pled facts alleged in the proposed second amended complaint set forth a plausible claim that these defendants knew their publications were false or had a high degree of awareness of the probable falsity, but went ahead and published anyway. That is the definition of reckless disregard. And the second amended complaint that Mr. Gold has been talking about did not cure the defects in the prior complaint because the facts that he actually alleged in that proposed pleading do not plausibly show that the defendants knew Mr. Pippin was not bankrupt or that they had a high degree of awareness of the probable falsity of their publications or seriously doubted their truth. There was some questioning about that Mr. Gold led into in his discussion of Hart Hanks. Hart Hanks restates all the basic principles requiring a plaintiff to meet the subjective standard of actual malice, but Hart Hanks was very different. Because in Hart Hanks, for example, the newspaper there had in its possession the denial of the fact asserted from five witnesses. The information reported was deemed highly improbable, and the newspaper refused to listen to exculpatory tapes in their possession. Very, very obviously different circumstances from the allegations here. As I think the court's questioning indicated, here the complaint is devoid of any similar allegations. Paragraph 35 essentially alleges nothing more than these defendants knew Mr. Pippin had been involved in a series of lawsuits, and there was nothing in the pleadings in those lawsuits saying that he was bankrupt. That's the allegation that's actually in this proposed pleading. And that, we would submit, if you looked at nothing else, no further context, and just took that as the pleading, that would not establish that these defendants knew Mr. Pippin was not bankrupt or entertained serious doubts subjectively.
Do we know what Pippin's financial situation was throughout this period?
Well, we don't know for sure in this record what his situation was. As you asked in your earlier questioning, we do know from a broader context, and by the way, Iqbal itself says the determination of whether a claim is plausible is a context-specific task, and that the court can look to the broader context of an allegation. In the Schatz case recently from the First Circuit, the court specifically said the court can use common sense, can take judicial notice.
I was just curious whether there's anything about his actual financial situation.
No. What you can tell from the very pleadings that Mr. Gold relies on, for example, is that Mr. Pippin alleged that he had experienced, and I'm quoting, extraordinary monetary losses from his investments. He had a history, as we talked about, of suing lawyers, any number of lawyers and others, to recover for $30 million in investment losses. That's in the pleadings, and we cite I won't belabor this argument with citations to the supplemental appendix, but there's any number of them. He is quoted as saying his own language, never, as far as we can tell, anything that he's withdrawn, that you can wake up one day and find that someone has taken everything that you had. And in the broader context, he was included in a series of prior reports describing him as broke, bankrupt, having lost his fortune.
Yeah, well, that's one of the curiosities. The initial report said that he had filed for bankruptcy in 2003, and many of the reports that are asserted to be defamatory in this litigation contain the same assertion. You know, that's very easily checkable. There is a good federal database of people who have filed for bankruptcy. How is it that the bulk of the American press failed to do the simplest thing, which is there's a concrete assertion that Pippin filed for bankruptcy in 2003, see whether he's a litigant in a bankruptcy case?
I, of course, can't speak for all of the American press. I can say
although that a good chunk of it has been sued in this case.
A good chunk has been sued, including my client. I will say perhaps it may have been something that could have been done, but we would respectfully submit.
What do you mean it may have been something that could have been done? It's as easy as pie.
They could have done it, Your Honor. I won't argue that that's not true. I will submit to Your Honor
nobody did.
And in this record, nobody did. However, the standard, the legal standard here.
I understand the defense saying we can get away with it. But, of course, what that sounds like is we know we can get away with it, so we have license to be irresponsible and not check.
Well,
since we can get away with it, just as a matter of policy, we repeat other people's defamatory statements without trying to find out whether they're true. You know, and the Constitution may allow you to do that, but it still doesn't sound like something one ought to be doing.
Well,
yeah, and then to go further, you know, Sports Illustrated gets the email from his counsel saying, you know, he didn't file for bankruptcy. They take it down. They issue an apology. So my question is it your position that a news agency can keep an article online that it later comes to know is false as long as it wants without any liability, as long as it didn't have reason to know it was false when it was first put online?
The answer to that question, I believe, is yes, Your Honor.
So it could just be online forever. You know it's false, and you never have any responsibility to correct it and check it.
As the law now stands, Your Honor, actual malice is measured at the time of the initial publication. The law has never drawn a distinction between Internet publications and publications in other media. They, too, for example, a television show or a newspaper, can issue a correction after the knowledge has been brought to their attention of falsity. But there's never been this line between Internet on one hand taking it down or correcting it and other forms of media.
So your position is until the law requires it, even though your client now knows it's false and didn't know it was false at the time, they do not have any obligation to correct the falsity online or whatever medium we're talking about, wherever it was first issued or whether it was first published, whether it's online, on the TV show or whatever, they're under no obligation to correct it when they absolutely know it's wrong and somebody actually checks the bankruptcy.
Yes, it's not that it has no significance, Your Honor. It does have a significance, for example, to damages, the damages that would potentially be recoverable. It can affect the compensatory damages that are awarded to a plaintiff. It could be a relevant factor, arguably, in states where there are other factors that go into the calculus of punitive damages.
But could you explain to me why actual knowledge should not require somebody to remove a statement from the Internet? I understand the conclusion in New York Times against Sullivan that there's, if you publish something on Tuesday and you learn the truth on Wednesday, it's already been published on Tuesday. But a statement on a blog on the Internet is not published just on Tuesday. It's published on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday. And if you learn the truth on Wednesday, why are you entitled to continue publishing it on Thursday?
Well, I think that comes up in other respects as well, Judge Easterbrook. For example, I do think the law with respect to other types of publications.
I'm not asking about other types of publications. I wish you would answer my question instead of a question of your own devising.
All right. Well, first of all, again, we would submit that there is nothing particularly different in the Internet publication.
I just gave you the critical difference. A newspaper is published on a day, and that's that. Right? A broadcast is broadcast on a day, and that's that. But suppose that CBS or NBC then puts up on its website or on YouTube a copy of that broadcast for anybody to watch a week from now after it knows it's false. If you take one of the classic examples of bad journalism, when CBS jiggered the accelerator of an Audi to make it look like it suddenly accelerated, right, and it eventually conceded that that was completely bogus and agreed to pay large damages. In your view, you could, with impunity, put that on the network's website forever, put the original broadcast on forever, with no liability because it had been broadcast initially? I just think you can't be serious.
No. Well, I would submit to the court, again, the standard is whether or not at the time of publication, the original publication, in this case, if you repeat someone else's defamatory publication and you put it up at that point in time, then your state of mind is measured then and when you post it.
Why? That's the question I asked you.
Well,
since something that is on the Internet is effectively republished every day, if you initially post it on Tuesday, you find the truth on Wednesday, and you decide on Thursday morning to keep it there because you really want to defame the person who's being defamed,
well,
why should that be allowable?
Well, Your Honor said in your question that that is a republication, and admittedly, for example, in the situation of the single publication rule, the law has been well established that publications are published only once, and that's at the time of the original publication. Now, I recognize that that is a rule of the statute of limitations and not actual malice. I acknowledge that. But that having been said, there's good reason for that, and the reason is because there's really no way to manage each and every publication. I mean, on the theory you're talking about, if one person accessed it one day, it's a new cause of action. And then
for a second. NBC runs a show on Sunday which contains a defamatory statement about which NBC has been negligent. On Monday, it learns the truth. And on Tuesday, in full knowledge of the truth, it reruns the program. Do you think the Tuesday broadcast is protected by New York Times against Sullivan?
Perhaps not. Perhaps, I guess
perhaps
it depends
not.
On the.
Surely not.
It depends on the broader circumstances.
Why is the Internet different? You post something that everybody can view on Tuesday. Why would that be different from a rebroadcast over the air on Tuesday?
Well, again, I take a step back and I suggest to the court that the decision not to retract, I mean, which is what we're really talking about here, or in your case, there's two different circumstances, Your Honor. One could be taking it down and the other could be failing to retract or not taking it down and failing to retract something. And I think what we're talking about here is a uniform stationary publication like a newspaper show, like a television show, or a newspaper article or a television show. And I don't believe that the...
So you think we should stay frozen in time? And, of course, we're in a new era now. We are online. Everything is online. I could understand your position if you said, look, we can retract on our online blog or, you know, website or whatever. So we could put our retraction on. But we shouldn't be held responsible for everybody else who repeats. That I could get.
Well,
but for your publication, when you know it's false, I still am back. I mean, just like I asked you originally about this, I don't see why you don't have an obligation to retract once you absolutely know it's false, the way Sports Illustrated did once they knew it was false.
First, I feel compelled to say, in fairness to my co-defendants on whose behalf I'm also arguing, that the questioning is really directed at my client, CNBC. There is nothing in the record to indicate that any
but
of the
see,
other.
But you see, as Judge Williams so I just want to make that clear. Just removing the thing may have no effect at all. It may have downloaded 50,000 times. So the only effective way to try to correct it is to publish a retraction. Because then the people who download who are interested in this issue will see it. We'll see the retraction. And they'll stop, you know, sending it to their friends.
But again, I would submit that's a slightly different scenario. Running a retraction is something that any other kind of media can do, and the law has been uniform that there is no duty to retract.
No, but I mean, but
as opposed to pulling
out. But
that's
where the Internet is special, as Judge Williams pointed out. Because this stuff, you know, spreads. It becomes viral, as they say. So now it's on a million computers. So just the fact that you withdraw it from your website has no effect. Only a retraction would. So it would be perfectly reasonable to modify our understanding of, you know, reckless disregard and so forth, duty of defamers, to say they have to, if it's online, you have to publish a retraction.
Perhaps. I see my time is up, but I would just simply say...
You can always answer a question.
I'm sorry?
You can always answer a question.
Okay. I would only say, Your Honor, that you are correct in your assumption you would be writing on a fresh slate because we've never seen any case in the whole...
We do that from time to time.
You do from time to time. You do from time to time. I would say that...
So if we were to write on that fresh slate, does that make sense to you?
I believe it doesn't.
Because it's like once you know it's false, it's online, you have to post a retraction.
I believe, Your Honor, that... we'd now be
right. Sort of, I understand what
we'd
your
be changing the actual malice, the whole core of the test, and it's measured at the time of publication. You'd be treating it as a new publication,
exactly.
And I acknowledge that's the basis of the question. I think a better body of law would be not to interfere in these First Amendment principles, but instead to treat it as a matter of damages. And that a defendant
yeah, but
who
see,
continues
you never get to
do
to the
it,
damages,
you never get to damages.
You, because you can't prove it was well, defamation. So I mean, well, that doesn't help anybody unless
you, you
show it's defamation. I mean, that's not helpful. So I'm just was looking at you to see if you had any limiting principle or anything you wanted. You know, if understanding what your position is, but it just because of the fact that it can be replicated on the internet, it can be republished time after time after time. You know, it's false. You should send the retraction in. So. I'm just looking to see if there's anything else you might want us to hang our hat on or any kind of,
well,
you know.
Yeah. I suppose, you know, if there was, I would think there ought to be a nexus at a minimum between the original publication and the later publication so that if the defendant, for example, said something in communicating the reasons for its decision on a retraction or on a correction, like, for example, we really doubted at the time of the original publication what we were doing, but we were on deadline. Or if there was some nexus between the original publication and the state of mind at the time of the original publication and something that occurs later, I suppose that could be a bridge. But as it now stands, there is none. There is nothing to show. The defendant didn't say, we didn't believe it at the time, we don't believe it now, or anything of that sort. But I still think there ought to be a nexus between the original state of mind and the later request for a removal.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Sanders. Anything further, Mr. Gold?
Yes, sir. First of all, Judge Posner, you asked the question of my opponent, is there anything in this record to indicate what the net worth of Scottie Pippen was during this period of time, and I direct the Court's attention to paragraph 18 of our second amended complaint, which says as follows, all of the defendant's above statements are false. Scottie never filed bankruptcy and indeed has a substantial net worth, which has not been less than approximately $40 million in the last 10 years. So that allegation, of course, has to be taken as true when the district court dismisses
Look, what I think is the most serious problem in your case, I don't think you comply with the requirements of Illinois law for either per se or per quod defamation. It's not per se defamation. And per quod, you haven't shown the special damages.
Okay. In terms of per se, we have cited to this court's decision, which didn't say bankruptcy, falsely calling somebody a bankrupt is a per se violation.
I don't think that's true, because there are all sorts of circumstances which can precipitate someone into bankruptcy. And, you know, per se, it's now. It's like, you know, you're impugning a person's ability to do his job and so on. You can go bankrupt, for example, because you have heavy medical bills. There's no obloquy that attaches to that.
Well, under Illinois law, Judge, if my understanding, that if it prejudices his or her ability in their profession, and in this situation, Scottie Pippen, after...
Yes, but my point is that just saying that someone is bankrupt is not a comment on this person's performance of professional obligations. Because he may have gone bankrupt because he signed an accommodation note, because he had heavy medical bills, because he had been defrauded by a broker.
I agree with you, Judge Posner. I do agree with you.
So that's out with per se. Now, with regard to special damages, what is the connection between this newspaper gossip, or internet gossip about him, much of which is true, apparently? They did lose a lot of money. Said he lost a lot of money. Now they go a step further and they say mistakenly that he filed for bankruptcy. But what is the incremental harm to him from that?
Well, we've alleged in the complaint, Judge, the differential in his offers and his ability.
Yeah, but of course he had lost a lot of money. He was in financial trouble. And because he was in financial trouble, that may have made, you know, the various people that he endorsed products for nervous. The question is, that's not the defamation, saying he's in financial trouble, because he says he's in financial trouble.
Correct.
So what's the additional hit that his business activities take as a result of being
under the Bryson case, Judge? The Illinois Supreme Court has said that if it prejudices him in his ability to earn a living.
Yes, you're not answering my question. I'm asking you, what is the incremental harm to his ability to make money of being called bankrupt? He says he's had these extraordinary monetary losses. Now, the newspapers embroider that, and they say he's bankrupt. Now, what is that incremental false characterization of his financial situation, exaggerated picture of his financial situation, what is that? What is the effect of that?
The cases, the financial situation which you described, Judge Posner, was there all the time when he was earning the kinds of money he was earning before the defendants raised the level of that litigation to his having filed bankruptcy. And in our amended complaint, we have the fact that after the bankruptcy, but years before when he was litigating, he was earning all these kinds of money. Now they come out with this lie about his bankruptcy. And now, specifically, we have alleged in our Second Amendment complaint how, in specific instances, that cost him his ability to earn what he was earning before they came out with the bankruptcy. So all these lawsuits in which he was attempting to get the money did not impact.
Well, have you alleged, for example, that these sources of residual earnings from a pro athlete fell faster for Pippen than they did for other comparable players who were not alleged to be bankrupt?
No, we have not. But
that would be the measure of the allegation of bankruptcy. There are a lot of pro players who, as time passes from the time when they were in the game, their endorsement earnings and their exhibition earnings fall. Well, I would think you'd have a good case if you compared Pippen to, say, Julius Erving or somebody like that. But I gather there was just no effort to do it.
Well, we haven't gone to trial yet. But in the complaint,
the allegations,
right.
Special damages, Rule 9G says that special damages must be specifically stated. So there's got to be something in the complaint about that.
That's correct.
Do you have any reason to believe it's true that Pippen's residual earnings have fallen faster than those of comparable athletes not alleged to be bankrupt?
No. But we do know as to Scottie Pippen, we have alleged it, and we know it, that it has happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what other...
No, you've answered my question. Thank you, Mr. Gold.
Your
time has expired. The case will be taken under advisement.